We've been looking at the role of women, the function of women in ministry, in the diaconate, as presbyters, whatever we know about that. We turn now to back to the reality of family, but we're going to investigate some known families in the Christian Empire. We're moving along here. We're way past the New Testament time and the second and third century, and we're moving into the fourth century now, in fact, the late fourth century, when the empire has been predominantly Christian for a while. And things are different than they were when Christians were a minority. Now Christians are a majority. They're in control. They're in government. And the old ways, the what we call pagan ways, were dying out. And so it's a new era in which it's the era of Christendom, really, in which Christianity is the majority, and so you can kind of take it for granted. So how are people living then? So we're going to look first at the family of one of the famous Cappadocian theologians, one of the fathers of the church, Gregory Nazianzen. Now, to look at the Cappadocian theologians as theologians is another whole thing that we're not going to do. We're going to look at their family life and what they have to say about it. Gregory's father was also named Gregory, and his mother's name was Nonna. She died in the year 374. Gregory preached the oration for his father's death, for his father's funeral. That was the customary thing. You would gather for the funeral, and you would get some great speaker to deliver what was a eulogy and a tribute and a very literary composition, which is delivered orally, of course, in honor of the deceased. And Gregory Nazianzen did this, and in the midst of the oration, he throws in some very interesting information about his mother Nonna. And so we're going to read some of that text. He says, "My mother was a worthy companion for such a man, for his father, and her qualities were as great as his. She came from a pious family, a holy family, but was even more pious than they." Pious, the word pious, I don't know in where you are what that connotes to you. That's not a really a terribly good translation. Devoted, I think, is maybe a better translation. Because pious now can mean sort of sticky, holy, you know, and overdone. So it's not that. So maybe we should think devoted. She came from a devoted family. She was even more devoted than they. "Though in her body she was but a woman," this is typical oratory, you know, "in her spirit she was above all men." So this is his mother he's talking about, and he's devoted to his mother. She's already dead at the time of her husband's death, so it's a past tense here, and she was just a woman, you know, but her spirit was better than anybody else. "Her mouth knew nothing but the truth, and in her modesty she was silent about those deeds which brought her glory. She was guided by the fear of God." For, he says, "the most excellent of men and of women were so united that their marriage was a union of virtue rather than of bodies." Now, it was also a union of bodies. They had several children. "Since while they excelled all others, they could not excel each other because in virtue they were quite equally matched." Now that's a really interesting way to say it. He still can't say in his culture that as man and woman they were equally matched, but by golly, in virtue they were. "But she who was given by God to my father became not only his assistant, but even his leader, drawing him on by her influence in deed and word to the highest excellence, judging it best in all other respects to be overruled by her husband according to the law of marriage. So he's alluding to the Pauline idea of subordination, the wife's subordination to her husband. But not being ashamed in regard to devotion, piety, to offer herself as his teacher. Admirable indeed as was this conduct of hers, it was still more admirable that he readily acquiesced. He readily agreed that she would be the leader, that she would lead him on to virtue and to Christian life. She was drawn to prayer first thing in the morning, to fasting and vigil, to all-night singing of psalms. She was the patron of orphans and widows. That's the end. So that's the end of what he says about his mother, Nona. It's just really interesting that she was a good wife, and she was a good mother, and she understood what her responsibilities were, but she also was the one who was equal to her husband in practice of Christian virtue. And he goes on to say how much she lived with prayer. When at the end of this, she was patron of orphans and virtues. Gregory actually says it in a very rhetorical way. What orphan was there who did not receive from her? What widow was there who didn't know her generosity? So he really portrays her as an ideal Christian. No question here of her being ordained. She wasn't. Gregor, her son, was a bishop when he's writing this. And so it wasn't a question of ordained ministry, but it certainly was of what we might call lay ministry, of her understanding and embracing the identity of Christian. Gregory also had a sister named Gorgonia, and Gorgonia was one of several siblings. She died early. She died while her husband and her parents were still alive. So this was a very sad thing for all of them. But Gregory has an oration, it's oration 8, on his sister Gorgonia, and it goes on for quite a while, and is what he has to say about her is quite beautiful. So Gregory's sister, her husband's name was Alypius. They had two sons and three daughters, and it's funny, we know the daughters' names and not the sons' names. The daughters' names were Alipiana, Eugenia, and Nona, who was named after her grandmother. And that was often a custom of naming children after a grandparent. Gorgonia, he says the same thing about her, that she surpassed everyone in virtue. In this case, it's in modesty and prudence and wisdom. And she even surpassed men in the chanting of psalms, the singing of psalms, and the knowledge of scripture. So we're talking here about a very highly educated woman. And again, we get these little hints. You know, these people they're not the top elite of the empire, but they're elites in their own place in Caesarea, in Turkey, in Asia Minor, and in Cappadocia. So they're among the top families, certainly, and they were wealthy enough. But you get the definite implication here of the women as well as the men being highly educated. He doesn't say the same thing about his mother, about her knowledge of the scripture, but certainly she must have had it. And by this time, education, Christian education, is in full force for teaching people through the scriptures, through the Bible, biblical text, and the singing of the psalms. This is the origin its early origins of what later develops into what we call the divine office, the morning prayer and the evening prayer of the church, that whose content is basically the Psalms, the singing of the Psalms, along with some reading and prayer. And this is what she's engaged in and what he is talking about. Now he says, this is this quote now, "She blended the excellence of the married with that of the unmarried state, proving that neither of them absolutely binds us to or separates us from God or the world." Now, I need to say here that by this time, particularly in the East, but also growingly in the West, they are beginning to cultivate the life of ascesis, which the ascetic life, which includes celibacy, virginity. And this is held out as an ideal. Gregory himself was probably celibate. We're going to see in a related family that there were a number of ascetic women. And it's an ideal. And so when he's talking about Gorgonia, who was not a celibate, she was a married woman, he has to kind of excuse her for that, you know, kind of explain it away, that even though she wasn't an ascetic, which would be the paragon of virtue, yeah, she was still right up there. So that's what he's trying to say here, that she blended the excellence of married life with the excellence of unmarried life, and she proved that neither of them either binds us or separates us from God or the world. For though she had entered upon a union of flesh, she was not therefore separated from the Spirit. So it wasn't that marriage, and some people were saying this, that in marriage it was impossible to be holy. It was the spirit of the age, you know. And he would have some sympathy with that position, but when he's going to say something about his own family, you know, that's not the case. And so he is going to say that she was just as good as any celibate that he knew. So she was not separated from the Spirit by her union of flesh by marriage, but performing those duties due to the world and nature according to the law of flesh. In other words, being a good wife and with sexual union and everything involved there and the care of children. So she performs the duties of the world and the flesh that rather are the duties of those of God who gave these laws to the flesh. So it all comes from God. And having all of that, she consecrated herself entirely to God. And that's very interesting language because it's usually spoken of virgins and ascetics, that they consecrate their entire life to God. And he's saying this of his married sister. I think that that what he does here with Gorgonia and with his mother are just really wonderful ways in which he gave tribute to women who are members of his own family, women who were in what was the majority situation of marriage, and he can defend marriage, and he can give a solid theology of marriage here, even though the prevalent idea among people like him was that the ascetic life and the celibate life was higher. So he goes on to say that she lived her role in marriage with prudence and piety, with no adornment. Now that is classic. You can trace it all the way back to 1 Timothy and 1 Peter in the New Testament, that women should not adorn themselves with pearls and gold, that their adornment is virtue. So this, and with elaborate hairstyles, of which there were plenty, And that the virtuous Christian woman does not wear all of this finery, does not have elaborate hairstyles, that her adornment is her virtue. So this is a very classic allusion that everybody would have expected him to say. So she was with prudence and piety and no adornment, and charity to the needy, again, like Gorgonia and Gregory's mother, someone who was known for charity, for giving to the poor. The Cappadocians, the three theologians are Gregory Nazianzen, Basil, and his brother Gregory of Nyssa, and then their sister Macrina, and we're going to talk about them later. They are known in their ordinary writings, their letters, and particularly their letters. They're known for concern for the poor, so that we get the idea that there was some kind of organized church charity for the poor, that there were, and this comes in earlier times too, centers of distribution. We even get that in Acts chapter 6 in Jerusalem, you know, that the seven are appointed to minister to the needy, to do the ministry of the table. And that's a whole study, that's another whole question, how charity was organized in early Christian groups, because we have a lot of evidence of that. And here too, somebody like Gorgonia would be actively participating in those kinds of charitable works. In the oration, Gregory recounts two stories, two episodes. One in which she had a fall and injured her leg, and through prayer, through persistent prayer, she was healed. The other was that she had some kind of a growth on her breast, and went to the altar and with cries and tears and earnest prayers begged for healing, and that she was healed. She was, and he counts it miraculously healed. And he tells those two stories in the oration. So he's really portraying her as an extraordinary woman. He writes that she died with a psalm on her lips. So the psalms were the living prayers that they prayed with. And as I said, it happened when her parents and her husband were present for the preaching of this oration. So she died, must have died fairly young, even though she had five children. We don't know what age the children were when she died. So this is again a portrayal of a nobly virtuous woman, fulfilling her role in marriage. Not someone who was ordained, but someone who was living out the finest ways of ministry to her family and to others in her own life, and I think for a time and place when asceticism was gaining popularity, as I said, these two are really interesting portrayals of Christian marriage.